This is Louisiana Considered on WWNO in New Orleans and WRKF in Baton Rouge. I'm Diane Mack. Just ahead on today's show, the Tennessee Williams Theater Company of New Orleans is back with a steamy Southern drama, presenting Williams's Summer and Smoke. And a River Ridge Little League team makes history and is honored in a special exhibit. But first, sitting on what's been called the edge of the world, Port Fouchon serves as a critical hub for the nation's oil and gas supply. But its location also leaves it vulnerable to hurricanes worsened by climate change. Now, as the Coastal Desk's Hallie Parker tells us, the seaport is taking a closer look at its own role in global warming and wants to be a part of the energy transition.
Travel to where Louisiana's land gives way to the sea, and then keep going. That's where you'll find Port Fouchon, the state's southernmost port, dotted with warehouses and docks. Nothing but open water lies beyond it. I took a drive around the 1,700-acre port with its executive director, Chet Chasson. In true South Louisiana fashion, we got caught in a rainstorm.
Can you kind of describe like what we're seeing?
Yeah, so what we're seeing here is, this is the Halliburton dock facility, or one of them, and then there are a couple of tanks with liquid mud and fuels. And
this like Halliburton, most of the port's 260 clients make their money servicing the oil field and natural gas industry. Fouchon is the home base for most of the fossil fuel production in the Gulf of Mexico, but it's also increasingly under threat. Climate change, fueled in large part by the industry the port serves, has led to stronger storms. And seaports like Fouchon are on the front line. Last year, Hurricane Ida thrashed the port with 170-mile-per-hour winds. We travel to one of several small marinas that the port's made for Louisiana fishermen.
We took a considerable hit on the wharves here from the storm.
Chasson gestures to the crumpled, broken piers that offer a stark reminder of the damage caused by the storm and the danger posed by sitting right on the Gulf.
We understand what our vulnerability is.
Officials in Port Fouchon are, for the first time, beginning to think about their own industry's role in climate change and starting to reimagine the port's future. That starts with data.
Oh, right there.
Yeah, right here.
On our tour of the port, Chasson points to a nondescript metal tower with different cameras, wires, and tech attached.
If you force me to identify what it was, I don't know, but it's on the top of the tower.
It's one of the things.
Correct.
One of the cameras is actually monitoring the area's greenhouse gas emissions in real time. Port Fouchon is the first in the Gulf to do this. Instead of using air monitors, most ships use math formulas to estimate their emissions based on how much fuel they use. That's how we know the maritime industry makes up about 3% of greenhouse gas emissions globally. But it can lead to undercounting.
The fact that we don't sort of have basic monitoring requirements has been a longstanding, frustrating issue here. A lot of the data that we would use or need is not necessarily there in the United States to make the most informed decisions.
That's Dan Hubble with the Ocean Conservancy. He says more precision is better as the pressure builds for marine companies to cut their carbon footprint. And the environmental advocacy group says more seaports need to help close that information gap. Port Fouchon's also started to think about ways to lower both their own and their customers' carbon footprint, but it's still really early. Chasson says it's important to show that industry and the environment can coexist. Many of the people who work there, like him, grew up in South Lafourche. They've watched the coast change due to land loss and have worked to rebuild some of the marsh.
We all have the mindset of doing what we can for us to be here for the long haul, to preserve not just the economic viability, but the environmental viability of our community, to keep our heritage and culture and our community intact.
In this case, the economic and environmental viability goes hand in hand. Shipping companies expect more regulations around emissions to come down the pipeline. So Fouchon's looking to help with things like
shore power,
which is building electrical hookups for ships to run on while docked.
That's the first thing on my mind that could lower emissions, is by having everyone, as soon as they get in, plug in. Don't use your generators.
And while oil and gas will be needed to fuel the energy transition, eventually more of Fouchon's business might need to come from another source, Gulf of Mexico wind farms. the wind giants that started building on the East Coast are already familiar with Fushan's offshore customers, and now they're coming south. That spurred a rebrand of sorts.
You know, changing that narrative to be, we are an energy service port. Whatever energy that is, that's what we're going to be involved in. And
Chasson says wind poses a real opportunity in the Gulf and feels they could see their first project move forward in the next 2 to 3 years. The isolated seaport will just need to be resilient enough to withstand climate change long enough to serve it. In Port Fouchon, I'm Hallie Parker.
The Tennessee Williams Theater Company of New Orleans is returning to the Marigny Opera House this month. Williams' poetic drama, Summer and Smoke, will mark the company's first production in the historic venue since 2019. The theater company's founding co-director, Augustin Carrero, joins us now with details. Augustin, welcome to Louisiana Considered.
Hi, Diane. Thanks so much.
This has been a long and winding road for your theater company. How does it feel to return to the Marigny Opera House?
It feels great to return, and it sure has been a long and winding road. This play was originally scheduled for 2020, and much like the last production we did, our first one back from the pandemic, For Whom the Southern Bell Tolls, we've got a cast that has been waiting for years to bring this story to the New Orleans audience.
We're glad you're back. How did you come to choose this work, Summer and Smoke?
This work was actually the first piece that we selected when we decided we were going to do the Southern Gothic theme. And it's the show that we built the Southern Gothic theme off of. Tennessee Williams has been called a Southern Gothic playwright in the past, and I think that this play really typifies that because it has so many elements of religion and southernity, which is a word that I'm not sure if it's real, but we're going to use it. And it has this reaching, yearning feeling that's so common in Gothic art and architecture that it just stuck on the playwright, and so we're just happy to be doing a play that so clearly showcases that aesthetic.
Now, where does the title come from, and what does it mean?
It essentially has to do with what's going on inside of the human body and finding where the soul is. It just so happens that summer is the season in which all of those things come bubbling to the surface. We like to think because of the heat.
Uh-huh. Now, this drama is part romantic comedy and part tragedy. What's the main conflict? What's the storyline?
The main conflict is really about a will they or won't they between the two protagonists, John and Alma, and whether or not they're going to get together or whether or not they're going to arrive at a place in their own lives where they're ready to get together with each other. We really hope that the audience is rooting for John and Alma, but there are challenges that they meet along the way, and most of those challenges come from inside themselves just as much as they come from outside in the world.
Where is this work set, and how does it evolve?
The play is set in a place called Glorious Hill, Mississippi, which is fictional, and it takes place in the Mississippi Delta, which, if you're from there like me, you understand is a little bit silly because there are no hills in the Mississippi Delta, glorious or not, very flat. And so it's a very small town, and that's one of the reasons why the expectations hit these characters so hard, is because the community is so small, repression is sort of the norm. And it takes place in 1916, so this is pre-World War I, and it's a really unusual time for a Tennessee Williams play to be set, because we often associate them with being set in the 1940s or 1950s and 60s. So this is a much earlier time period, even though it came out within a year of A Streetcar Named Desire.
Wow. Now, the two protagonists in this work are very different from one another. How so?
John and Alma grew up next door to each other. Alma is the minister's daughter, and John is the son of the town doctor. And Alma, growing up in the shadow of the church, had a serious complication when she was young because her mother suffers from a mental breakdown and goes into a form of sort of like late childhood. And so Alma has to take on all of the responsibilities of taking care of her mother, as well as essentially having to play the minister's wife rather than the minister's daughter. And so she's really saddled down with all of these responsibilities and attitudes that have to put forth a good showing for the church. John, on the other hand, bucks at his father's respectability and kind of wants to be more of a wild child and rebellious. So when he goes off to become a doctor, he does so begrudgingly, and he returns to his hometown in sort of a hedonistic way. He's all about collecting as many physical experiences as he can, which is completely the opposite of Alma, who is all spiritual and intellectual.
What was going on in Tennessee's life as he penned this work?
This would be Tennessee Williams's third major success, or at least major production on Broadway. And what had happened was Glass Menagerie had come out, Streetcar Named Desire came out a year before, and so he was on this sort of golden boy tear. He was the hot playwright of the American theater. He was also engaged in a relationship with somebody here in New Orleans, and so he was spending a lot of time in New Orleans with Pancho, as well as visiting New York and other cities for the out-of-town tryouts for these plays. So there was a lot going on in his life. It was a very exciting time for him. And this play, because it was written within the same year as Streetcar Named Desire, sort of becomes overshadowed by Streetcar very often when it's looked at historically.
Alma and John are such opposites, as we talked about, but there is an attraction there. Do their personalities eventually rub off on each other?
Absolutely. Alma and John have undeniable chemistry, both in the text and in the performances being done by Elizabeth McCoy and Justin Davis, who are just incredible at carrying this entire two-act show with such chemistry and electricity between the two of them. But the characters do begin to rub off on each other. And fortunately, unfortunately, some of the strongest held beliefs and values of each character have to diminish as they assume the aspects of the person that they are so in love with, but can't quite arrive to, or at least for most of the show.
You have an all local cast?
We do. We like to keep the casting local because we want to give opportunities to artists who live here in New Orleans so that their friends and loved ones and their neighbors can come and see what an amazing and talented city we really are, not just musically, not just visual artistically, but also in the theater. We like to keep it here because we have so much incredible talent that we don't really have to go looking very often.
Tell us about the set.
The set is a multi-level, incredibly tall, gothic masterwork by Steve Schepker. It's one of the largest sets that we've ever had, and part of that is to feature into that Southern Gothic theme of reaching higher and presenting so much to look at, even in the most simple of settings, like a church or a rectory or a doctor's office.
What would you say is your signature on this work?
I think what we're bringing to this show is a reading of it which is very true to the text and showcases all of those things that we come to expect from Tennessee Williams. But we're also doing what we traditionally do, which is to blow off the dust from the museum glass above the play and really make it alive and relatable. And we work very hard with our actors to make sure that they understand every aspect of the play and can connect it, because when it can connect to those actors, it really can connect to the people in the audience. And folks are not so different than they were in 1916 when the play takes place, or in the 1940s when Tennessee Williams wrote it. It's just a matter of bringing that life back into it and not trying to stage a movie on the stage, because movies will always do a better job at doing the movie. We want to do the play for 2022 for our audience.
What will be the takeaway for audiences?
I think the takeaway for audiences is a message having to do with the human spirit. And it is that these human spirits that we all have inside of us, whether we can see them on an everyday basis or not, are there. They are ever present. They are sensitive, and they are so complex. And so there's a message here of forgiveness, a message that allows us to change and allows us to be different and to be better and to live up to the people around us in the ways that are good for us, rather than being dragged down into the mire of doubt and repression.
Tennessee Williams Theater Company of New Orleans founding co-director Augustin Carrero, thanks so much.
Thank you, Diane. It's always a pleasure.
The Tennessee Williams Theater Company of New Orleans presents Williams' poetic drama, Summer and Smoke. Performances are running now through August 21st at the Marigny Opera House. More info is online at twtheaternola.com. Thank you. listening to Louisiana Considered on WWNO in New Orleans and WRKF Baton Rouge. Back in 2019, the East Bank All-Stars became the first Louisiana team crowned Little League World Series champions. Last weekend, the team from River Ridge was honored at the Louisiana Sports Hall of Fame in Natchitoches with a new exhibit called The East Bank All-Stars Making Little League History. To learn more about the exhibit, Louisiana Considered's Alana Schreiber spoke to the man who spearheaded this idea, none other than Louisiana Lieutenant Governor Billy Nungesser.
Take me back to 2019. When did you learn that a Louisiana team had, for the first time, won the Little League World Series? What was your reaction?
Well, it was unbelievable. You know, we've got so much sports history in Louisiana, so much talent that starts at that young age, but to finally have the first Little League World Champions from Louisiana and a scratch team put together out in Kenner, Louisiana, just made it all that more special. And to now that we're through COVID, to have them honored in the sports museum, where the Sports Hall of Fame, where all the famous heroes of Louisiana are, it's kind of icing on the cake.
For anyone who doesn't remember, what can you tell us about that series? How the team played throughout the season, their records, and any exciting moments on the field?
Well, I just remember, you know, when you go into a game like the championship, you have high hopes, but you know that is where it, you cut through all the luck and everything. You got to leave everything out there. And winning 8-0, August 25th, 2019, everybody jokes about that day, but to have them go in and win that thing decisively and see the way that team played together, and we just made it all that more special. And to know that these kids got a trip to the White House, to the governor's mansion, to ride on a float, it just was a storybook celebration. They made history, and Louisiana will remember them in the history they made.
You know, I'm remembering a few years ago in the Little League World Series when Monet Davis, a female, was a star pitcher. She made the cover of Sports Illustrated. That was a big story. I feel like we hear more about Little League baseball than we do most any other Little League sport. So what do you think it is about baseball that gives such inspiring stories?
Well, you know, the reason I love baseball is your individual talents are what it is. But it's also, you got to play as a team. Whereas in football, if you've got a great team around a so-so runner, he's going to do really well. But a great runner without a line. So an individual's talents, in my opinion, does not excel like in baseball. There's only one person up at that plate. You either hit it or you go back in the dugout. And so the individual performance is highlighted, but yet they still have to work as a team. And you see that come together in youngsters is really impressive because they have to be mature. They have to be patient. They got to work hard to reach their goals. They've got to be passionate about it.
Right, because baseball is offensively very much an individual sport, but defensively, definitely a team sport.
It really is. And I think it to see the maturity in these young men, but yet once they win it, to see them celebrate and realize they're just kids, I'm always impressed with how mature and how when they step up to that plate, you know, you realize you're looking at a kid, but they're doing the same things the professionals do. And they really take it serious. They concentrate and they're focused.
Absolutely. We are speaking with Louisiana Lieutenant Governor Billy Nungesser about a new exhibit at the Louisiana Sports Hall of Fame to honor the 2019 World Series championship team, the East Bank All-Stars. Well, what exactly is going to be on display at this museum? Tell us a little bit more about the celebration and who will be there.
Well, hopefully all the teams and their families. We're hopefully going to have some sports writers, the press there. I'm hoping we'll be able to get some interviews of what it was like. and then put on display photos, some of the equipment, some of the video, and really try to encourage more people to come out and see this. I was there when they came into the airport. I was actually asked by one of the coaches early on when the team was raising money to go. I wrote one of the first checks to support them before we knew. So it was personal for me because I saw the passion and the determination and hard work that the coaches and the parents and the sacrifice they made to get there. So I've been following them on a long journey.
You seem to be involved in a lot of projects that recognize prominent Louisianans and our history. You helped unveil a historical marker to commemorate the McDonough Three, who integrated a public elementary school in New Orleans. You've also done a lot of work on the National Civil Rights Trail. I'm wondering, why do you get so involved in these kinds of projects? Do you see it as a personal interest, part of your role as lieutenant governor, or some of both?
Both. I have a real passion for what I do. I love helping people, but I tell people we've got something in the soil here in Louisiana that grows so much talent, whether it be musical, whether it be sports. We really do have some great heroes. And, you know, when I started the Civil Rights Trail, I was embarrassed at a conference in Arizona. Alabama, Mississippi was talking about their trail. We had none. And I came back and went to work and found out very quickly that a lot of the first movement was here in Louisiana. The first bus boycott was actually in Baton Rouge, where a lawsuit was filed by Dr. Jones 17 days out of law school. And since we've started this trail, the National Trail has recognized 9 new sites from Louisiana. And before we're finished, Louisiana will probably have more sites on the National Trail than any other state. We're well on our way. We've identified 15 markers we're putting up. Later this month, we'll be in Bogalusa for that 114-mile walk from Bogalusa to Baton Rouge that inspired a lot of marches around the country. So we've got so much history and special people in Louisiana highlighting their accomplishments, the changes they made that changed the country. We owe it to the people to bring that history to light.
This has been Louisiana Lieutenant Governor Billy Nungesser. Thanks so much for being here.
We thank you for your time and covering it.
This has been Louisiana Considered. I'm Diane Mack. Thanks to our guest, coastal reporter Hallie Parker. Tennessee Williams Theater Company of New Orleans founding co-director Augustin Carrero. And Louisiana Lieutenant Governor Billy Nungesser. Our managing producer is Alana Schreiber, and our digital editor is Caitlin Umholtz. Our engineers are Garrett Pittman, Aubrey Procell, and Thomas Walsh. You can listen to Louisiana Considered Monday through Friday at noon and 7:30 p.m. It's available on Spotify, Google Play, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Major support for Louisiana Considered provided by Rouse's Markets, a Louisiana shopping experience, with additional support from Louisiana Farm Bureau Federation.